Imagine if the next presidential election came down to one guy, a guy named Bud. One night, Bud's shaken awake by his young daughter. He opens his door to this. The flashing bulbs and media frenzy of a political firestorm. Turns out Bud is the swing voter, and everybody wants a piece of him. Kevin Costner plays Bud in the new movie Swing Vote. It opens this Friday. I spoke with him earlier. So, Bud, he ends up being the one guy whose vote the entire election turns on. It's really circumstances that make the Florida recount in 2000 look tame.
Yeah. Yeah, both what happens is it does come down to a single vote, and no one's sure how it's been cast. There's been a voter error. Legally, they have 10 days for this individual to recast his vote. And so what happens is you have Kelsey Grammer playing the Republican president and
Dennis Hopper.
Dennis Hopper is playing the Democratic candidate running for the office. If you got two men vying for the biggest job on the planet, is it any wonder that maybe when their base is reduced to one that they begin to waffle?
Yeah, there are these fantastic a really bright spot in the movie are the parodies of political ads that these two make to try and get Bud's vote.
And at the same time, separating themselves completely 180 degrees from what they really believe.
Bud, with your help, this Republican administration will say, I do, to gay marriage.
I do.
I do.
I do.
The Democratic candidate makes a anti-abortion rights
and
ad,
immigration.
A pro-life
people are just running across the border.
Right? Yeah. That one was very funny. Now I have to say though that as we're talking about both sides being represented as being pretty flimsy.
Yeah.
In the end, it does seem like the correct stand on the issues in this movie is pretty left of center.
I don't know where you're going there, but I'm listening.
Okay. For example, the working poor, the issues that really seem to coalesce as the issues to be worked on in this country are about the working poor, health insurance, jobs. There isn't really much talk about bloated government, taxes, the sort of social conservative agenda other than this farcical commercial on gay marriage.
Well, we couldn't take on the whole issue. I mean, this isn't 13 days.
Sure.
It's not JFK. It's a comedy, and ultimately those issues I don't see as being left or right. That's what always bothers me about life. I mean, it seems to me in the country that about 80% of our problems are not really problems. They're just problems that exist between people who can't get their ego out of the way in order to solve things for Americans.
But it seems like the issues you choose and the priorities you put them in, the movie ends up looking like you want people to vote, but you kind of want them to vote for the Democrat.
I didn't really get that feeling, but that's the beauty of a movie. Somebody else got that feeling. I thought what happened at the end was that Bud, instead of doing a rah-rah speech, he looked at himself and he dug really deep, you know, and ultimately he said, an average man is going to pick between two exceptional men. Does that seem fair? Not really, but that's what it's wound itself down to.
You portray one reporter getting a lot of pressure from her producer or her TV producer back at the station. And there's a line where he says something like, this is bigger than God. This is television.
Yeah. This isn't news anymore. This is television. This is bigger than news. This is television.
Right.
Listen, I have a lot of friends in the business that you're in, and I can't tell you the writers that have to write about me or interview me or whatever, the pressure they come under once their story's turned in, how it gets re-edited, and they see their story evaporate down to some kind of story that we've, all seen. And when a producer says no, you ask him about his first marriage. You do that. And you go, I don't want to do that. And you go, you do it. The air goes out of the room.
So tell me about your first marriage. No, I'm just joking.
Gotcha. You almost didn't have, you couldn't even let it lay there long enough.
I couldn't help myself.
Yeah, you couldn't even let it lay there to go, beat, beat, beat. That's a joke.
You're right.
Beat, beat, beat.
Beat, beat, beat. Your band. You formed a band.
Yeah.
Called Modern West.
Yeah.
And You're coming out with a CD in October.
I don't want to, I'm not content to just be what people think that I am. Music was a part of my life before movies. I was in the church. My grandmother was the, played for the choir. My mom was in the choir. I was a wise man as 8 years old, you know, and all the Christmas stuff. So I would sing Oh Holy Night, you know, and all that stuff. I took classical piano. I've, you know, found myself around the world, even doing these press junkets and finding myself in a city and in hotel rooms. And I talk about the movie or whatever. And I don't really have an exchange that I feel comfortable with. And being able to play music, if I was playing tonight in Washington and you were able, you know, to come see it, I would gather that you would have a different feeling about me. It might be a bad feeling or it might be a greater feeling, but it would be what I would call an expansion of a relationship where you go, I know now more about him than I've ever known. So I love being in front of people and telling stories, whether it's in music or in movies.
Kevin Costner's new movie is called Swing Vote. Thanks so much for coming.
You're welcome.
Two films out this week offer a change of pace from the summer blockbusters. Instead of superheroes, these movies feature realistic young people. Bob Mondello says American Teen, which opens Friday, is a documentary that plays like fiction. And Boy A, which opens today, is fiction that plays like real life.
At the start of Boy A, a slender young British guy, about 20 years old, faces an older man across a table, looking apprehensive.
How do you feel?
Oh, I don't know, it's like I'm having a dream.
Well, you're not kidding.
It's not a dream, but sort of a dream come true, though it comes with decisions, and he's not used to making decisions.
They said I could choose my own name.
That's right.
Any name.
You got one?
I can't make up my mind.
For a decade, he's been officially known as Boy A. That's what the court called him when he was convicted of murder when he was just 10 years old. Now, Boy A, who decides to call himself Jack, has come of age and is being released into a world that thinks him a monster. He doesn't look like a monster. He looks terrified. But as he makes a friend and learns to deal with things that he hadn't had time to learn about before he went to prison, like restaurants, he starts to be less fragile. Then something terrible happens that seems wonderful as it's happening.
She's alive!
He rescues a child.
You okay?
Saves her life, is hailed as a hero, which gets his picture in the paper. So his new identity starts to unravel.
The 23-year-old man was reported to resemble Eric Wilson. Wilson was recently released from prison.
Boy A, based on a novel, is carefully calibrated to explore the solitariness of a character who cannot let himself be known. Director John Crowley employs boyhood flashbacks and scenes of a romance Jack strikes up with a coworker to let you grow attached to him before society lowers the boom. Jack, as played by Andrew Garfield, is agonized and desperately anxious to get things right, something you might also say about the filmmakers who have turned Boy A's very particular story into a scary, universal, and wrenching social statement. If there's a statement in the documentary American Teen, it escapes me. That title sounds just as nonspecific as Boy A's title, but the film's Indiana high schoolers feel less universal than generic. Filmmaker Nanette Burstein follows her subjects through their senior year and shows us kids who seem to have been less intent on math and literature than on studying MTV's Real World and what kind of confessions work best on camera.
I spend a lot of my time playing video games. I love The Legend of Zelda. I don't have many friends, so it's always been really important for me to have a girlfriend. To be honest, I wish life were more like video games, because then I'd always get the girl.
This is the film's representative geek with acne. We also meet a personable jock, an overprivileged beauty queen, a handsome heartthrob, and an independent-minded rebel who seems to have her head screwed on straight.
I applied to San Francisco State University. They have an amazing film program. So I have completely made up my mind to stay away from anything like a boyfriend type attachment. I'm trying to be completely ready to leave Indiana. Knowing me, I will find someone and I won't want to leave. And I don't want that.
Naturally, the heartthrob then comes a-callin'. The students all say and do more than they should in the filmmaker's presence, which certainly makes them watchable, sort of a slow-motion train wreck, but it also raises questions. What was the director's responsibility, for instance, as she filmed one of her underage subjects spraying hate crime graffiti? At what point does the filming of kids behaving immaturely become invasion of privacy, even if parents signed consent forms? And why is the most interesting student on screen, best friend to the rebel, not ready for his close-up? Reticent, not a camera hog, he stays on the fringes of the screen, either smart enough not to crave unearned celebrity or lucky enough not to get it. At one point, his eyes brim with tears, and where the front and center kids have long since grown tiresome, about this American teen, as about camera-shy boy A, come to think of it, you can't help wanting to know more. I'm Bob Mandela.
Today, Attorney General Charles Bonaparte recruited a handful of investigators from the Secret Service. They would form a new branch of the Justice Department. The Federal Bureau of Investigation was born.
Like many another success story, this one had humble beginnings.
It's a story that really inspired Hollywood.
I'm going to take you back to those days and show you a motion picture about a man named Brick Davis who was in the Bureau. It's the daddy of all FBI pictures. The first one that called us G-Men.
G-Men have been a staple in Hollywood ever since there was a Hollywood. So here are a few of our favorite FBI flicks.
I heard something about you today, lawyer.
You did? What?
You're going to be a big G-Man.
That's right.
You ought to be dropped in a ditch, stool pigeon.
Remember to keep your tin badge in Washington. If you come around here sticking your puss in our affairs, you'll get a belly full of this. Now beat it.
What's his problem? We're handling our caseload. I'm surfing on my own time.
I know it. Just don't rub Harp's nose in it.
Look, Angela, you think I joined the FBI to learn to surf?
You're being tasked to headquarters, where you'll be riding the desk of an agent named Robert Hansen.
He's a traitor, Eric. Started spying for the Russians, we think, in 1985.
What if he's smarter than I am?
He was smarter than all of us.
Dr. Lecter, my name is Clarice Starling. May I speak with you?
You're one of Jack Crawford's, aren't you?
I'm still in training at the academy.
Jack Crawford sent a trainee to me.
You're scared because I'm getting close. I know you. You rented that car, Shreveport. You stayed at that hotel in Lake Charles. You want to run, be my guest.
Stop chasing me.
I can't stop. It's my job.
Just a few of the great FBI moments in movie history. We heard from G-Men, Point Break, Breach, Silence of the Lambs, and Catch Me If You Can. What are your favorite FBI movies? Visit NPR.org and click Contact Us to send us a note with FBI movie in the subject line.
Back now with Day to Day. The Batman sequel, The Dark Knight, broke box office records this last weekend. No surprise there. But the critical acclaim is more than most people expected. Real raves for Heath Ledger as the Joker. As critic Andrew Wallenstein says, that means an opportunity come Oscar time.
When the Academy Award nominations for Best Supporting Actor are announced next year, I'll bet anything Ledger will be among them. Critics are practically tripping over themselves to praise his chilling portrayal of Batman nemesis, the Joker.
Why don't we cut you up into little pieces and feed you to your pooches? And then we'll see how loyal a hungry dog really is.
That a comic book character is generating Oscar buzz seems a little strange. The awards are traditionally dominated by so-called prestige pictures. These are typically art house dramas, high on artistic integrity, but low on box office receipts. And that could be one reason the ratings for the Oscar telecasts on ABC each year have been in a death spiral, 2008 being the lowest yet. After all, why should a mass audience feel invested in films most of them have never seen? Like, say, last year's Oscar darling, Atonement.
Yes, I saw him.
Just as you see me.
I know it was him.
You know it was him? Well, you saw him.
But here's the thing about Ledger. He's not the only one in a popcorn movie this time of year that gave a great performance. So perhaps it's time Oscar voters start to reevaluate just what their standards are. I mean, let's face it, there is an elitist bias on the awards circuit against movies that make a lot of money. It wasn't always this way. Titanic and Lord of the Rings were huge Oscar winners in their day. But now it's as if quality could not possibly exist within a film intended to drive quantity. But I don't think many people see the two as mutually exclusive. Take, for instance, Robert Downey Jr.'s work in another mega-successful summer film, Iron Man. It's worthy of a Best Actor nomination. I don't think the film was all that good, but his individual performance was as good as any I've seen this year.
It's an imperfect world, but it's the only one we've got. I guarantee you, the day weapons are no longer needed to keep the peace, I'll start baking bricks and beans for baby hospitals.
You rehearse that much?
Every night in front of the mirror before bedtime.
Should Downey be disqualified from contention because he happened to spend a portion of the film flying around in a metal suit? I hope not. If metal is a deal-breaker, that could also bode badly for WALL-E, the animated tale of a lonely robot. WALL-E is probably the best movie I saw this summer. Every year, Pixar seems to produce top-notch movies that only get noticed in secondary categories. But isn't it high time for a Best Picture nod? Hell, I'd settle for a secondary category like Best Screenplay for Judd Apatow, the writer-producer responsible for just about every great comedy the past 3 years. He was ignored for The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up. Can we get him something, anything, for Forgetting Sarah Marshall or Pineapple Express, just two of the comedies he's attached to this year? Of course not. Oscar seems blind to anything but drama, though I'd pit a great comedy like Knocked Up or even a great action movie like The Bourne Ultimatum against anything nominated in recent years. Mainstream movies are capable of achieving a quality worthy of Oscar recognition. Maybe it's time to do some recognizing, if for no other reason than saving the Oscars from obscurity.
Andrew Wallenstein is a deputy editor at The Hollywood Reporter.
The economy may seem rough for everyone right now, but there is one group that benefits from an economic slowdown: military recruiters.
They're strong, and then there's Army Strong. It is not just the strength to obey, but the strength to command.
The trends that we have definitely seen, usually in economic prosperity, it's more challenging to recruit, and in economic downturns, it's less challenging. That is one trend line that seems to hold constant.
That's retired four-star Army General Jack Keane. General Keane was Vice Chief of Staff for the Army and one of the architects of the troop surge in Iraq. We'll hear more from General Keane in just a moment, but first a peek into the life of a military recruiter. It's the subject of a new documentary premiering tomorrow night on HBO.
Do you think you want to see foreign countries, like maybe Europe or, you know, the Far East or South America or something?
The film is called The Recruiter, and it follows Sergeant First Class Clay Uze as he looks for soldiers among the young people of Houma, Louisiana.
Elvis Presley, Axl Rose, Dave Thomas. You know who Dave Thomas is?
Yeah.
The guy who founded Wendy's, right? Yeah. Now, what do all four of those names have in common?
Famous.
Well, besides being famous. United States Army.
Okay. All right. Edie Bilsberg, the film's director, says she was drawn to the town because of Sergeant Uze's reputation.
I read an article about the Army Times Soldier of the Year, who happened to be Sergeant Uze, and he received that award in part for recruiting more young men and women into the Army than any other recruiter at that time.
Here's a scene from the film where Sergeant Uze is talking to kids at a local high school.
What's up, Big Mark? What y'all dressed up for?
Basketball game?
Just two y'all playing tonight, huh?
Yeah.
7 o'clock?
Yeah.
I got an appointment at 6, but when I'm done, I'm going to try to run out. And hopefully I can make at least, you know, halftime or whatever.
All right, sorry.
All right, Mark. Good seeing you, man. We'll see you later on during the week.
Sergeant Uze joins us now from Houma, Louisiana, where he grew up. Good morning, Sergeant.
Good morning, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. And yourself?
Doing great.
When we listen to that clip, you're clearly trying to be friends with these kids. Is that an important part of being a recruiter?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't really class it as, you know, friends, but ultimately a role model and a mentor. I was very fortunate in my tenure as a recruiter that I had a very receptive community that welcomed me into the high schools and allowed me to mentor some of these young men and women to, you know, life-altering decisions, rather it be the military, college, or the workforce.
There is a lot of rejection in the film, as I'm sure there is with the job of being a recruiter. We see people hanging up on you on the telephone. We see parents warning you away, saying, basically, stay away from my kid.
Right.
Why were you willing to let a documentary film crew watch that rejection?
Well, you know, I think it's important that, you know, America gets the proper information and realizes the challenges and the strifes of military recruiters in an all-volunteer force. You know, and there were challenges that I met, and the film captured those challenges. I mean, every day is not an easy day.
In the film, you mentioned that when you first started recruiting, you almost felt guilty that you were working a desk job while your friends were still serving in Iraq,
right,
in Afghanistan.
Well, yeah, you know, and that was something that I experienced. It was an emotional feeling, and ultimately, the war's kicking, and I know that I have the qualifications and the skills to be out there leading men. But at the same time, I realized one day that, hey, I have the ultimate responsibility of getting the good quality people that they need to continue to support our missions.
How do you talk to recruits about the possibility of being killed in action?
You know, when I was on recruiting duty, that was one of my, I guess, for lack of better terms, one of my pet peeves. If I really had a recruit or a family member or a significant other that wanted me to, you know, dispel some myth that, hey, I'm not going to deploy, that was kind of one of my statements when I met. I thanked that parent. I thanked that applicant for taking the time and sitting down with me. But I was like, hey, let's get something off the board because your time is very important to you and so is mine. If you want me to try to tell you or give you a guarantee that you're not going to deploy to a foreign country to defend your nation, then we need to end the interview right now.
In the film, we see parents who, frankly, don't want their children going to war. And it's the parents that are concerned mm-hmm. about their kids dying. It's
right.
It's understandable. And in fact, there's a point in the film where you're talking to a recruit named Chris about his mm-hmm. stepfather and his stepfather's misgivings about him enlisting. Let's listen to that.
Your stepfather, no disrespect to you, is my personal opinion, is an armchair quarterback. I will not be questioned by a guy that sits on his couch all day. I'm not going to argue with the stupid. I don't care if it's your dad. I'm going to call an ace of spades, ace of spades. I'm going to tell you, you're right or you're wrong. Because guess what? I'm like your dad now. And I will not tolerate it.
Sergeant, that seems a little harsh.
You know, I'm not exactly sure how the tone of that conversation went, but I think that that is also a little misleading in the film. And I've discussed that with the filmmaker in detail as well. It's kind of a loose term to call him a stepfather because his mother's husband was only in his life for maybe 6 months. But my overall point to that young man is that I was a subject matter expert about soldiering. My personal opinion is that he was a pretty lazy figure in society. And this young man is currently on his second tour in Iraq and is a proud soldier and very proud of his accomplishments.
From what I saw in the film, you may have been one of the few adults in a lot of these recruits' lives that actually spent time with them, that seemed concerned about their health and their future, that talked to them with respect.
That's my personality. That's why I serve my country. That's the thing with these recruits, you know. I've seen potential. I've seen young Americans. When I look out into these crowds and stuff, you know, having come back and been a veteran of war, you know, I've seen America. And I've seen a lot of potential in a lot of young men and women that maybe hadn't had the best shake, you know. And if I met those, I treated them with dignity and respect like I would treat anyone else. You know, I had no control over how they were reared up until that point. But ultimately, I guess through me, they may have discovered some things. And hopefully they did, because a lot of them are doing really well.
Sergeant First Class Clay Uze is the subject of a new HBO documentary called The Recruiter. He speaks to us from his home where he grew up, in Houma, Louisiana. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Robert.
I believe in God, I believe in family, I believe in country. My name is Sergeant First Class Clay C. Uze. I am now and will always be a guardian of freedom in the American way of life. I am and will always be an American soldier. America's Army, ready and relevant. Army leads the way.
Sergeant Uze finished his tour as a military recruiter in 2006. Since that time, the Army has met or exceeded its recruitment goals and is on pace to do so again this year. But it remains a challenge. Army officials estimate that almost 7 out of 10 young people do not qualify to enter military service. General Jack Keane, who we heard from earlier, says some recruits can't meet basic requirements, like getting a high school diploma.
It's a sort of a sad indictment in the sense that among American youth today, that statistics you have is pretty accurate. I think it's in the high 60s. They cannot qualify for military service in terms of, one, they do not have a diploma. Two, they cannot meet our aptitude test scores. which is also a problem that we have. And I believe that's a bit of an indictment of our education system. It would seem to me that if you graduate from a high school and your military gives you an aptitude test for to meet the challenges of military service, you should be able to pass that test. But we have a surprising number of people that cannot meet the minimum aptitude test scores for qualification for military service, and that's a sad thing in of itself.
Keene says other recruits fail to meet the physical standards required by the military.
We're challenged by the serious obesity that some people have, and in some cases it's a medical disqualification. In some other cases, we can work with the youngster, you know, tell them to come back at another time after they've lost some weight, get them down to a reasonable amount of weight, because what we do not want to do, you know, just put somebody through 6 to 8 weeks of basic training and have them come out the other end, you know, still not able to meet the military standards of military service in terms of weight goals.
In recent years, the Army has increased the number of waivers granted to recruits who may not have otherwise qualified for service, and they're going to need everyone they can get. General Keene says the Army is in the process of increasing the size of its force by 65,000 by the year 2010.
Now on to our bloggers' roundtable. Disney rethinks its first black animated heroine amid accusations of racism. With us is Jay Anderson of Average Bro, freelance writer and nonprofit consultant Amy Larimore of the blog Alid's Work in Progress. She blogs with her husband at Political Season, and pop culture critic Desmond Burton of the blog Afro Nerd. He also hosts Afro Nerd Radio on Blog Talk Radio. Welcome, everybody. Disney is fending off accusations of racial stereotyping in its forthcoming animated film, The Princess and the Frog, an American fairy tale which features its first black princess. The original heroine was Maddie, a chambermaid for a cruel white debutante in the 1920s New Orleans. Maddie's fairy godmother reportedly was a voodoo priestess who would help her win the heart of a white prince after he rescued her from the clutches of a voodoo magician. Now, after word of that plot got out, Disney began making some changes, first to its title, The Frog Princess, which some interpreted as a slur. Also, the heroine has been recast as 19-year-old Tiana, and the race of the villain has also reportedly been revised. I don't know if you are parents or not, but I'm going to start with you, Jay, and here it is. Many are asking, why did it take Disney so long to make a story with a black prince? And now that it's here, people are complaining about the way that she's being depicted. What's your take on this?
Well, you know, I have a 2-year-old son, and I happen to agree. I mean, I would find this movie offensive. I mean, as parents, we are responsible for making sure that our kids are taking in images, you know, that are going to make sense to them. And in this case, you know, if you have a villain who happens to be black, if you have the knight in shining armor who happens to be white, you know, that's just too much going on, again, for a movie about a princess. And I think, again, the criticism of Disney is valid. I think what this does point out, though, is that unfortunately, when we as black people when we don't control our media, these sorts of things are bound to happen. I mean, a good example would be really from my 2-year-old son. The only thing that he can watch on television that really affirms him is Little Bill. You know, it's a cartoon that comes on Nickelodeon that happened to be put together by Bill Cosby. There's really no other equivalent, unfortunately. I mean, there's nothing else that affirms him as a 2-year-old black boy in terms of cartoons. And that's unfortunate, but again, it's a byproduct of the fact that we as black people do not control our own media enough, and movies would be one offshoot of that.
Are you finding, Desmond, that this is a big topic on the blogosphere these days?
Not as big as I would like it to be. I mean, I think I did mention this on my blog also, but my problems with this particular issue is that what would happen if we did control this particular issue or particular topic? Sometimes we can be our own masters of stereotyping. We just go to BET or TV1. So, you know, and also, I mean, I had a problem with the fact that the name was changed from Maddie to Tiana, because I thought Maddie was a quality name, but because of the oversensitivity portion of this thing, Maddie sounded like Mammy, which is ridiculous to me. And it kind of goes back to the whole niggardly versus the N-word debate, or recently the black hole thing. So I think, to be blunt, sometimes African-Americans are confused. I mean, you know,
really?
In some respects. I mean, it's 1920s Louisiana, and there's got to be some degree of accuracy as to what that time period meant. So now we're making her Tiana in 1929. I don't know any Tianas in 1929.
That's an interesting point. Amy, you have kids?
I do, and I have an 8-year-old daughter, and I have to say that I think we're just not looking at Disney for Disney. If you look at Pocahontas, Belle, Snow White, Jasmine, they all have issues. And so I think we need to spend less time talking about the first African-American princess and talk about what happens to get the next prince and three princesses down the road. My daughter's peers don't have to look to one princess to help her create her image. And I'm not looking to Disney, master of killing off mothers in their show, to affirm my daughter. I agree. When I think about the name and the sensitivity, Tiana doesn't relate to my daughter any more than Maddie did. And I think that when we try to influence the story, we lose some of the original aspects of the fact that they're going back to original art with a mother who's a graphic artist. I have a great interest in seeing them use original artwork and not just computer generated art. So I think there are aspects that we can look to, but we need to ask the question of ourselves, where are all the other princess stories? What are we doing?
Do you think that these films really do have an impact on your children? To what extent?
I do, because I see what happens with the mass media and the birthday parties and the costumes and the attire. You know, we're talking about just a $1 billion business of making little girls feel worthy and making them feel happy. And I don't have a problem with that. I just think we have to have more than one image and not rely on Disney to create the ideal.
All right, we've been talking with Jay Anderson of the blog Average Bro. He was at NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. Pop culture critic Desmond Burton of the blog Afro Nerd. He also hosts Afro Nerd Radio on Blog Talk Radio. He was at our New York studios. Plus, freelance writer and nonprofit consultant Amy Larimore of the blogs Alid's Work in Progress and Political Season. She was at member station WFYI in Indianapolis, Indiana.
For more about these and other movies, visit our website, npr.org/movies.